This episode of the Order 66 podcast brought to you by the generous donations of Kevin Malone, Donald Weller, B. Witzel, Andy Bethel, Darren Hampton, Trevor Hill, and William Sullivan, as well as lots of viewers and listeners like you.
D20 Radio, where gamers roll. www.d20radio.com.
Broadcast live, you're listening to the Order 66 podcast. Brought to you by Gamer Nation Studios, D20 Radio,
and Wayne Basta, author of the Aristia series of novels.
What is up, Gamer Nation? GM Chris here. For those who may be tuning in for the very first time, this is the Order 66 podcast, the original podcast entirely devoted to Star Wars role-playing. And we have a gaggle of guests with us tonight, but of course, joining me in the regular hot seat is my co-host and the man with the plan of extraordinary capability, ability, and questionable morality, Mr. Phil, GM Phil. What's up, my man?
Welcome to 2016 Gamer Nation, the post-Force Awakens era.
God.
We are here and we are going to have some fun tonight.
Are we? Ooh.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Well, we are absent one of our co-hosts, Mr. Dave, who is not able to join us tonight. But in his place, we have three people who are going to... three additional people that are going to hopefully help us make this episode... pretty smash-tacular awesome. And the first of those would be returning to the Order 66 podcast. It's been almost a year since we've had you on, sir. Far too long. FFG's own Andy Fisher. How are you doing, sir?
Hey, guys. I'm doing pretty good. It's exciting to be on.
I'm glad to have you back, sir. Very glad to have you back. And you, like, things have changed for you at FFG. You are in a new position there that people might not be aware of.
Yes. Last year, I took a position on our design team, so I'm just doing new game designs for all different departments now. Dude, a little less work on Star Wars roleplay, but... Yeah, I know.
But a more global position. But
yay!
You obviously took the lead position on something very important that we're going to be talking about later, but assisting you tonight and us, we also have a couple other crazy cats. Phil, maybe you want to lead into these two nut jobs?
Well, we would most certainly be starting off with Mr. Keith Cappell. Long
time. Hey,
guys. Happy to have you back, Mr. Keith.
Yes, sir.
And, of course, Keith's cohort and favorite wingman from the realms of web-based gaming goodness, that would be Mr. Ryan Brooks.
Good evening.
You know, Ryan, I refer to Keith as your wingman.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Keith pays me a stipend, so, hey, he can stop billing.
It's worth it.
I see how it is.
Totally, totally worth it. Well, we have you three fine folks on tonight, as we will get into the meat of our show in a little bit, to talk to us about the recently released Strongholds of Resistance sourcebook for Age of Rebellion, which, you know, Fish, you were the lead developer on, if I'm not mistaken, at that time.
Yep. It was my last book as a full-time developer for Star Wars Roleplay.
Wow. This is like a teary moment then. I'm so glad you're here. This is like full circle.
I know, it's a little sad, but I still get to help out a lot with all the other exciting stuff we have coming up. So
awesome. And of course, we are joined by the inestimable Mr. Brooks and Mr. Cappell, because you guys both worked as freelancers on the book and wrote quite a bit. So we were really glad that you guys were able to come on and talk about the book with us. But before we get into it, we do have a few announcements to get to and through. So let's do that now.
Hello there.
What have we here?
Good news.
Announcements.
Announcements! Why don't we get started with our featured podcast of the week. After a hiatus of a year, The Bad Boys of Pathfinder are back with Chronicles, the Pathfinder podcast re-rolled, returns from the dead with episode 20 as Azmuth and Steel Wind catch up on their games and campaigns before interviewing Ben Looms, creator of Sirenscape, as well as Matt Morton and Tobias Drury of Mesa Mundi, publishers of D20 Pro. The boys then welcome the return of authors Richard Pett and Greg A. Vaughn for a special spotlight on The Blight by Frog God Games. Then, author Mike Scheel checks in to discuss his unique 64-page standalone module, The Dragon's Demand, in spoilerific fashion. Man, they just line up the guests more so than even we could. This return podcast is over 4 hours long, and it's good to have you back, boys. Of course, you can find Chronicles podcast and many more great podcasts over at www.d20radio.com.
Oh, yeah. And now for some juicy bits of web goodness, hot off the keyboard of Mr. Sterling Hershey. After his recent live appearance on our last episode, freelancer and Jedi Master Sterling Hershey weighs in with his episode 7 thoughts in his weekly Star Wars Wednesdays blog. Great read. He talks about his reaction to the film, kind of his viewing experience, reactions after the film, and also spends a fair bit of time pimping out the Order 66 podcast and our recent episode, talking about episode 7. Thank you, Sterling. A really good read from a legend in the industry, and you can find it and a whole lot more at www.sterlinghershey.com. So, head there and read.
And while you're googling the interwebs, be sure to head over to the best gaming blog with the freshest daily content from the best writers who have all publicly forsaken the dark side, www.d20radio.com. Even though the Christmas and New Year's weeks, the daily hits just kept on coming. In this past week, amidst our slew of articles, were two notable Ask the Gamer articles. First, Off the Rails, by the inestimable Kevin Rikoshi Frayne, as a wonderful treat that every single Star Wars GM and player should read about railroading, player and GM participation, and truly playing an RPG to meet the best expectations. The second was GMing the One Trick Pony. It was written by none other than GM Chris.
Hello.
Expressing his own thoughts to RPG GMs of all stripes with the best tips and tricks on dealing with the One Trick Pony player. You can find that and so much more daily at www.d20radio.com.
Word. And of course, the social media plug. Gamer Nation, stay in the know by following D20 Radio on the Facebooks. If you're not a member of the D20 Radio group, you should be, because we provide cool news and thoughts and funny things and, of course, podcast info from all of our network podcasts on a daily basis. You can also follow us on Twitter at D20 Radio. And if you want some private ruminations, you can also follow us individually at GM Chris, at GM Dave, and at Darth GM. We post and tweet show info and announcements regularly. So be sure you're following, because we want you to. And now it's time to stop down for 1 minute and check in with SWRPG Adventures and the most informative 140 characters or less on the internet. With SWRPG Adventures, Adventure of the Week. Welcome to Star Wars Adventures of the Week, brought to you by SWRPG Adventures on Twitter. This week,
a crime lord opens up his secretive operation to 5 lucky ticket holders, ostensibly to find a successor. but his number two plans to take out the competition.
This has been Star Wars Adventures of the Week, brought to you by SWRPG Adventures. For more adventure ideas in 140 characters or less, be sure to follow SWRPG Adventures on Twitter. And remember, keep adventuring!
Okay, I love SWRPG Adventures. They're phenomenal. And Keith, you actually tweeted in response to this one a while back. What was it? Jolly Jabba and the Glitter Stem Factory?
That's true. That actually happened. With Ugnaught Oompa Loompas or something like that. Yeah.
Oh, that's God. Perfect.
There was a bit of back and forth. It was fun.
I love it. I absolutely love it. Well, gentlemen, are you three fine folks ready to get down and talk about some strongholds of resistance?
Oh yeah,
let's do it.
Well, let's do it. Yes, the resistance is strong with this one. Tonight, we are talking about the recently released Strongholds of Resistance. And the Order 66 podcast is very pleased to welcome back D20 Radio's own Andrew Fisher. Dude, this is your fifth appearance on our show, if you can believe that.
Apparently.
You were kind enough to last join us to talk Stay on Target with Jason Marker. And 11 months later, we are very proud to have you back to talk about the recently released Strongholds of Resistance, really the first system-setting book for Age of Rebellion. Now, Keith, I'm trying to think, the last time you were with us, I think, was to discuss the AOR GM's kit.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Yeah. I think this is like my third time. When do we get our free sandwich? How many appearances?
I'll buy you a sandwich when you come to Gamer Nation Con in March and April.
Sold.
Done?
Sold.
Done? It's done. It's done. And Ryan, I'm trying to think. Is this your first time as a proper guest on the show?
I believe it is.
Well, man! Woohoo! It's wonderful. It's wondrous.
Thank you.
It's wondrous. As Keith and Andy can tell you, it only gets better from here.
Admittedly, we set that bar really, really low.
So I'm very grateful the three of you were kind enough to take your time to help talk to all of us, because I want to talk about Strongholds. I mean, for a game that's really steeped in rebellion insurgencies and daring and dangerous locales, a lot of fans were really waiting for kind of a catch-all book that could add a lot of ideas and potential meat to their Age of Rebellion games. And tonight, we're going to ask you all our questions, and the listeners' questions, about the production of Strongholds for Resistance and really what went into its creation. So, Gamer Nation, lock your X-Foils into attack position, warm up those targeting computers, and secure those Death Star data tapes tight as we visit the most iconic locations of the Rebellion with Strongholds of Resistance tonight on the Order 66 podcast. So, Filbert, where should we start, man?
Well, we always need to set the stage, really.
Mm.
And setting the stage for any good book deals with production, design, and just general creations about how it all came together in the first place. So I guess where we should probably start, Andy, is let's start with the hard sell. Our first question tonight comes from Kendrick, who says, I have not had a chance to thumb through the book yet, and I'm initially inclined not to buy it as I'm running campaigns run from an Imperial perspective. So could you do a hard sell of the book for people like me? How easy would it be to convert these bases to enemy locations? Why should I buy this book?
That's a good question. I think I would I'd say first and foremost. So this is a book, you know, focusing on worlds that are important to the Rebel Alliance. And so, you know, it often gets sold as a book about Rebel Alliance worlds, but I mean, one of the things about the Galactic Civil War is there's really not too many actually Rebel Alliance worlds, right? There's Imperial worlds that, like, happen to be in Rebellion or happen to be important to the Alliance. So because of that, most of these worlds either have an Imperial presence or, you know, have some the Imperials aren't just going to let them go without a fight. So I would say that this is actually an excellent book for even an Imperial campaign, because these are the worlds where the Rebels and the Imperials are going to be butting heads the most. So if you're playing an Imperial campaign where you're butting heads with the Rebels, it's probably going to be at one of these locations.
Not a lot of planets out there that are openly flying that orange flag with the Rebel bird on it, huh?
No, and those that are not exactly safe.
Well, they kind of blew up Alderaan for just being, you know, to make an example.
Yeah, that really didn't work out as planned either.
No, no, it really, really didn't. Also, I got to say, I just got called out in the chat room because of a verbal slip. In my earlier, I said X-Foils a minute ago.
It's S-Foils. I was going to say something, it's but S-Foils. I didn't want to interrupt.
Thank you for not interrupting, but you should have interrupted because of the S-Foils. S-Foils! Oh, that's embarrassing. Okay, but why is it S-Foils? Shouldn't it be X-Foils? Now
strike
that I'm thinking
foils.
About it. Huh?
Strike foils. It's any swinging wing. It doesn't necessarily just have to be the X. On the B-Wing, when the little wings flip out, they're still S-Foils.
Well, then they should be B-Wing. B-Foils.
The S stands for strike, as in there's weapons mounted on them.
What if there's not
you
weapons
should know
mounted
this.
On
You should know this, Chris. I'm very
What if there's not weapons mounted on them? I don't know.
Yeah, on the wingtips, lasers, bro.
But what
lasers.
If there's not? I'm Oh, thanks. In chat,
they don't do that then.
And they're just swivelly bits. Then it's swivel.
Yeah, to be fair, on the ARC 170, there aren't any guns on those foils that swing out. They're just
yeah,
wings.
But that's a great that's a good example. But I think like they only deploy those in atmosphere, maybe because they're heat sinks, which I don't think would do much in space.
I don't know. You
no,
can make
no,
sound
no.
in
they
space.
They were deployed at the Battle of Coruscant.
Were they?
They were out. Yeah,
and
they
that's
were out.
Weird, man. It's just weird.
Yeah, Keith's right about them being heat sinks, though. We always thought that was weird, but there's air in space in Star Wars, apparently.
Yeah,
that's, why, that's how sound happens.
I would make the case that actually the entire Star Wars galaxy is in a very dense but clear nebula, and that's why you can hear the starships in space, and things explode really big and burn for a long time, and they have things like heat sinks.
Because,
you heard it here first.
Because Star Wars. And in chat, Kaoso says, Chris was foiled again.
Boom.
Boom. Okay. Well, that aside, maybe we'll be talking about some S-foils when we get into Shep's discussion of the book. But,
awesome.
Yeah, so Andy, that's a good answer. And I'm really, as we continue with our discussion, I kind of interested to get y'all's thoughts on that whole comment you made about the idea of an Imperial campaign. I think that's very interesting. But, you know, with this, with thoughts like that in mind, that kind of leads me to a broader question. I mean, really, ultimately, what were the design goals for this book? I mean, it seems to have had a pretty tall design goal. I mean, tons of locations, multiple settings. This isn't really like the Hutt book. It really isn't like even the Corellian book. I mean, this is more galaxy spanning than what we've seen so far. So, I mean, can you talk to me about that? And was it daunting?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it wasn't that daunting, but we did set out with a slightly different design goal. You know, as you mentioned, with our Edge of the Empire setting source books, we kind of zoomed in on a very specific section of the galaxy. But with the Galactic Civil War, it's kind of happening all over the place, right? There's no like one sector where everything's happening. So we kind of wanted in this book to just highlight some specific locations instead of zooming in on a specific location or a specific sector. So to do that, actually, I very early on, I contacted, I believe it was you, Keith, and Sterling. And I this is before we hired any of the freelancers for the book. And I was just like, give me your guys' pitch for your list of the most important worlds to the Rebellion. And they produced a very long list.
Yeah.
That we got to work
that.
With.
Yeah, a few.
I'm sure there was something along the lines of when you get that list, like, okay, could you chop this down to a fifth, perhaps, and give me your top 10?
Well, I think my favorite was Keith produced this list that just went on, and Sterling replied to the email saying something like, man, there are worlds in there I haven't even heard of.
Yeah. Well.
Damn, son.
I have a background as a research intelligence analyst. It was comprehensive.
Which was amazing.
Were there bullet points, graphs, pictograms?
I think just bullets.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Okay.
And I can only imagine because there are some top tier planets and you guys hit them all and introduce a couple new ones or at least ones that, like you said, aren't very well known.
Yeah. And I want to talk about that specifically. I want to get into some of those strongholds here in a bit. But, you know, this is interesting. I mean, this book, I think more maybe than any other in the, likely in the red cover line, also seemed to me, and I maybe you guys can talk about this because you mentioned the idea of being, maybe playing an Imperial campaign. This book can be very useful. But to me, this book seemed to be a lot about being a rebel. You know what I mean? I mean, more than I think anything else that we're going to see out of this line, because of its very nature, talking about these strongholds, there's a lot in here about being a rebel and running as a rebel. I mean, what's your take on that?
That's just a lot in the nature of setting source books. Our other books tend to be more toolboxes for mm-hmm. the players to use to create their own characters, whereas these books... our writers, like Keith and Ryan, really get to delve into the Star Wars setting, right? And they're really kind of trying to pull out the essence of the Star Wars setting for this game line, and handing it to the GM and the players, so that they can tell a really thematically appropriate and accurate story. So because of that, we're less just handing them tools to use and more setting the stage. And so I think because of that, it comes off a lot more thematic. And that's where you get that kind of like, this book has a very strong rebel feel to it because of that.
Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, and this is really a question for all three of you, in your own work and in that, what sources of inspiration fed into the book? I mean, what parts of the Star Wars saga or other media kind of inspired you most in your writing and in the overall design?
Well, yeah, since Keith and Ryan wrote all of Chapter 1, I'll let them answer.
No, I would probably say a pretty significant amount came from like your old West End Games type books. There was quite a bit of discussion between Keith and I about a lot of the things that ended up getting put in there. And really, yeah, we were just trying to something that's kind of contrasting to the more region books. We wanted it to be kind of emphasized that, like, yeah, rebels don't really have, you know, quote unquote, worlds that are theirs, and it's a very piecemeal type situation with the Rebel Alliance. So, probably the West End Games books. There was a lot of the Stackpole novels ended up getting put in there.
Very cool.
That's probably.
Keith, what about you?
Yeah, man. So, I mean, me and Ryan together did all of Chapter 1. So I think the first thing we had to do was finalize the list of planets. I know Andy gave us a few, but especially in Ryan's section with the smaller planets, we had a lot of freedom to kind of decide what might make the final cut or not. And I know for me, just from my time in the Navy and the stuff I did there, like, I was trying to look at the Rebel Alliance as sort of it's a big military insurrectionist organization, and it's going to need, like, a lot of different things to be able to do that. So I wanted to make sure that we had, like, safe worlds and agro worlds and places where starships got built and things, all the things that the Alliance needs back to, I wanted to make sure that we had sort of at least one place that could represent one of these major logistical things that the Alliance has to have in order to function at even a basic level. So I was really excited to see worlds like Chardan get in there, and some of the agro worlds, and Sanctuary and New Alderaan and stuff like that. Yeah, and so I think, like, huh? Go ahead.
Oh, no, there's a lot of, like you said, Chardan, that's a good example. There's a lot of things that... emphasize the Rebel Alliance actually siphoning off of the Empire themselves in order to fight them.
Mm.
So I think my military background had a lot of influence, like, on that chapter. And also, like, the major planets that I worked on were, like, Chandrila, Kenyan, Moncala, and Sullust. For those, for some odd reason, as I was researching them, certain sources kept coming up, like, again and again. One of the weird ones was the old Nintendo 64 Rogue Squadron video game. like that game goes to Chandrila, Moncala, and Sullust. So it's like there was this narrative thread in there that I'm like, oh well, I guess I could kind of bring up Rogue Squadron and all these and see if that still fits. And Moff Cole Seerdan was like the big villain of that game. He's mentioned in the book. So that was like one of the weird sources that got referenced. I think Pod Racer 2, Racer's Revenge, came up like twice in this in those first few planets because there were courses on Mon Calamari and Sullust both that seemed like good locations to talk about. I don't think I was too obvious that that's like where I got that from, but for fans of that game, they might have had a little nerd explosion if they caught it.
Well, there are little bits like that. There are little bits like that through a lot of these write-ups and a lot of stuff that's in here that's drawn from the various video games. I don't want to get too far ahead, but I got to ask, which one of you did Chandrila?
Oh, that was me. Yeah, you're talking about the Bar Sen Thor, I imagine.
Dude, as a long-time Jedi Jedi Battlemaster, I got to thank you for giving the nod. I would like to think that somewhere on Chandrila, there is a fat Twi'lek lying in a tomb with Jedi robes and a double-bladed lightsaber just waiting for one of my PCs to find. Thank you, man.
I think that's actually the second time I've mentioned that, too, that specific thing about the Warden of the Jedi from the Tor MMO video game, for those of you who don't know. I think I made that connection in the Force and Destiny Core rulebook as well. It's in there somewhere. So it was weird because that was like, I think that was the job I worked on maybe two books beforehand. So I was like, oh, look, another chance to make that connection again. So I think I made it a little more strongly this time.
Oh, yeah, no, you're right. You're right. There's a brief write-up on Chandrila, and it's mentioned, you mentioned the Bar Sen Thor's tomb, like, in a sentence, I think.
Or in a sidebar it might have been in. A lot of the sidebars had, like,
sentence in a sidebar or something.
Yeah. But that's actually from the Jedi Academy video game as well. That's where the Crystal Caves came from. So there's like an odd amount of video game references just for the planets that we got. Because over the years, so many Star Wars video games have gone to so many of these major Rebel planets, right?
And if there's work there to already draw from and build off of and bring it into here, it's, you know, I don't want to say that some of the work is done for you, but some of the idea seeds, I'm sure, are things that you can draw from and have drawn from.
I wouldn't say that makes it easier, Ryan. I don't know how you think, because you incorporate a lot of stuff like this too. I think it's harder because you have to do 10 times the research. It'd be easier to just make up something random. But
true.
To do all the research and then make sure you're writing it in a way that's not going to drive Pablo or Leland crazy or that Andy and Sam are going to look at and be like, you got that from a video game, you idiot. Put something better in because that's lame. So, like, there's a lot you have to do to sort of, like, massage that stuff and reference it just enough so that the hardcore people that are into it get it and, like, vaguely enough that it's not going to step on toes or drive anybody crazy just trying to do their job.
Yeah, yeah, and so it feels like it flows in nicely, right? Like, it fits into the setting instead of just being a call-out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can't, like, bend over backwards just to be like, I need to find a way to fit this in. It has to, there has to be, like, a natural sort of organic way for that to fit.
It's got to make sense.
Yeah.
Interesting. Now, one of the perks of using established canon sources that are a bit out there, especially I think in the video game realm, was the fact that those games often provide us with a lot of iconic imagery that we can call back from, you know, previous, you know, our artistic representations of locations in some way. And in terms of the art in this book, we have some pretty beautiful maquettes and other nice character shots and other wonderful pieces of art that are really representative of a lot of the Rebel locations and faces and characters of the Rebellion. And as usual, Zoe and company, phenomenal job. I want to ask, and I'm actually going to start with Phil on this one, and then maybe Andy, Ryan, Keith. Did you guys have a favorite piece of art in this book? Because there's a lot.
I didn't, although I did have a certain classification of what I found to be my most favorite art, and that is any of the two-page cityscape or locationscape pictures.
Mm.
So much of these books are about It's a duh comment to make, but so much of these books are about the location, and I really grab onto that visual piece of art that sees the background, because I don't get that often enough. We get some great pictures of characters, we get some great pictures of battle scenes, but sometimes I need that picture to be able to see, okay, how is this city different from the other? From the picture of Chandrila to the Roche asteroid field to the underground caverns of Sullus, which sometimes can be a trick for me to try to wrap my head around.
Yeah.
You know, that the Sullustan people make their cities within these volcanic caves beneath the surface of the planet. I love what FFG put together here with your landscapes. They're gorgeous. They're inspiring, and they really set the mood for wherever the PCs are going to.
Phil, I really agree with you, and there's just a thing I'd like to add. There was, like, when they were doing the Clone Wars, Dave Filoni did these, like, behind-the-scenes videos where he'd talk about his meetings with George Lucas and all that sort of stuff. And one of the things he said is when you're telling a scene in a Star Wars story, there's, like, rules. And it's, like, first you have to show a planet, then you have to show the city establishing shot, and then you could zoom in and begin whatever your story is. But there's always, like, those two shots beforehand when you're switching locations like that. And I think those city pages are those, like, big location images, the sprawling big images, are important at the RPG table, too, to have that moment. Be like, here, look at this. You're in this. And just for a moment, and then move on.
It's funny. You actually got you guys actually sort of do that throughout the first chapter. You got the planet with the stat block on it, and then as you flip through the pages, you get the establishing shots afterwards.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm glad you like them. They're definitely those big panoramas and stuff are something we want to include from when we start working on the book. But they're like, budgetarily, they're something you kind of have to plan for. It's like, how many of these can we swing, you know? And so, you know, it's something like, we know we need as many of these as we can get. How many can we, like, afford to work with and stuff? So they're definitely a consideration from the very beginning, and which one, how to prioritize them and stuff.
There is one neat pairing that I really appreciated and just liked it from a whole visual design perspective, and that's the Defiant Core base's sort of scene image and its map.
Yeah.
The scene image, you've got this cave with all the, you know, the ship. It's in this huge cavern. Lights are on, spotlights around, and this giant shaft of light is shining in across the cavern, across the bow of the crashed cruiser. And then you turn the page and you get to the actual map, and you did it there too. You've got this wonderful picture where there's the outside of the jungle in the northwest corner of the map, and there's this giant, just this huge shaft of light shining in, just like in the picture on the previous page.
And
everything else is shrouded in darkness. I dig that. That was cool.
And that's, for those following along, that's pages 88 and 91.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's Zoe's work. When I passed her those two descriptions, she was like, we need the same artist to do this so we can coordinate. So she made sure that happened.
Nice.
That's awesome. That's just awesome.
What about you, Andy? Is there any particular piece that you really enjoyed seeing and seeing when it got into the book?
I think my favorite of those cityscapes we were talking about is the one on page 30 and 31, the Mon Cal city from the air. But I think my favorite piece of art from the book, as far as development-wise goes, is on page 100. And it's of this X-Wing flying next to this Mon Cal sea creature. And so when I gave the art description, this is an example of something that happens quite often where we kind of write an art description with something in mind and we get something completely different. And I wrote this description of like an X-Wing being chased by TIE fighters skimming low across the water, and you can see a silhouette of a creature underneath. And when the artist came back, so I was just like, leave it vague or whatever. But the artist... you know, really got into it and made this piece with this giant sea creature bursting out. But when we saw it, we were like, all right, that's sweet. We got to go with that. And so we ended up, even though, it was not what we had initially expected from the description, it was just so awesome that it felt new and interesting to me.
Holy crap. I just noticed that there was an X-Wing in that picture.
Oh, me too.
It's very
too.
Small.
That shark is huge. The thing eating the shark is even huger. I just thought, oh, great, big sea monster eating a shark. Okay, that's cool. Christ, that's a big fish. Wow, didn't even notice
There's always a bigger fish.
There's always a bigger fish. Yes. Nice work. Ryan, Keith, favorites?
You know, I'm just impressed by pretty much everything in the book. I think probably looking at the overhead shot of the the spokes of the Mon Calamari city on what was it, page 31? Yeah, that's a pretty impressive shot. I like that.
We really haven't gotten too many good pictures from Mon Calamari from Dak. I mean, I think there were some city shots from various comic books that have been out there throughout Dark Horse Comics' career tenure with the line, but we really haven't had anything near like this, I think.
Yeah, the surface was very difficult to reference. The Clone Wars shows some stuff underwater, but they don't do a lot on the surface in the Clone Wars episodes.
Yeah.
Again, one of those amazing pieces.
For me, I had a bunch, including like that Mon Cal City and Defiant Core Base are two major standouts. But I also love the, I think it's Hanna City, but the Chandrillon City on page 8.
Yeah.
I thought that was another awesome city. And then there's a picture of, I think it's the Crater City on Kinyan with the statue of the goddess Tholen. And I really like that one because you look at that and you're like, wow, this is definitely an alien place. I really like that picture. And also, I think in the art description, I said, like, make it like the Jesus statue in Brazil, only make it a grand.
Yep. And, that's the first thing that I thought of when I saw it.
It turned out pretty awesome. And then I also just like the close-up of the Verpine Tech on page 96. I think that's awesome.
Well, anything Verpine is awesome, so.
Yes.
Fair enough.
Oh, that's just fantastic.
Then, of course, there's the Mon Cal writing Cthulhu on page 35. Gotta call that out.
My favorite cityscape shot was page 39. The city of Under Sullust.
That's what I'm talking about, man.
It's so meaningful, and it looks like, for those of you who are familiar with the reference, it looks like Menzo Berenzen.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what it reminds me of. Just absolutely wonderful. But I'm a huge fan of character art, and there were some amazing character art pieces that kind of struck me. The Verpine Tech you mentioned earlier on page 96, 97 was just a standout. The other ones that really stuck with me were a lot of the chapter headers were just phenomenal. But page 120, there's an unidentified rebel on Hoth with a beard, rocking beard. And a tauntaun. Absolutely love that. But my favorite piece of art, I think, is another character piece. And I'm just in love with the concept and the idea. And when I look at a character image and it makes me want to go make a PC right now of that character, on page 138 is a Celestian resistance fighter who looks like he's a Taras Kassi monk, but he's got like a bandolier of thermal detonators and a big gun on his back, and the robes, and you know.
I want you to know that I can blow you up and shoot you, but I don't need to. You're right, man. That is a solid and inspiring piece of art.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I just absolutely love it. Absolutely love it. Okay, well, let's get into some stuff proper here with this book, guys. And cool. as we get into this, I want to ask one final question of each of you very quickly. This might be a bit preemptive, but I want to get it up from you up front now so we can maybe know where to focus a little bit of time later on as we talk about the nuts and bolts of this book. I want to talk about your favorite part of this book. What is the most favorite thing to you found in Stronghold? A ship? A piece of gear? A location? A species? One of the modular encounters? In other words, what made you giddy when it got to be in this book, if you had to pick one or maybe two things? Andy?
Well, the thing I was most excited about as a player is probably Mon Cala. Just as a setting to set adventures in, you know, you're always in Star Wars, you're always in space, right? But rarely are you underwater, and like it's so similar to space but so different in many ways. And so I like the kind of flipping the tables on the PCs by dealing with the underwater issues of Mon Cala. So I was really excited to get that all written up for this book.
In the years I've been jamming this system, I have yet to place my PCs underwater. And it just this now with this seeing this here, it inspires me. So I'm very.
Yeah, I was gonna say, now's your chance.
Now's the time. Now's the time. Now's the time. Ryan, what about you?
I think just being able to flesh out some of the existing worlds a bit more than some of the other sources in the past been was really exciting for me. I particularly liked the Roche asteroid field and being able to mention a couple of planets like Chardon and Contrum.
Awesome. Keith?
For me, it was I fought for it because I wanted it really bad, and I was really excited that the Independence got in there. Because and got treated as a location on top of it. That was amazing. And, dude, I got to make up a new planet in Star Wars, Ord Gimel. That was pretty awesome.
Sweet.
Well, okay, so, Phil, since all of their favorite things seem to be strongholds themselves and locations, should we move into that?
I think that's a good segue, yeah.
Okay.
So, as a system-setting sourcebook, Stronghold's Resistance... First couple chapters provide us the backdrop, history, and a nice bit of education on the Rebel Alliance, and more specifically, the bases. The base is the wonderful basis where the Rebellion operates. So let's start there. So obviously, we've got so much material presented here, and we have a couple of intriguing questions, and let's just get started with these varied strongholds. Blackbird 88 asks a couple of intriguing questions. What was the thought process behind selecting some of the material covered from older sources? And what was it like adding in entirely new material, such as Ord Gimel?
I think Keith can probably answer that better than I can, since he worked on the section. But I will say before I let
him
go...
We have sort of gone over this a little bit already. Whole drawing from the West End game stuff and drawing from the video games.
Yeah, it's always kind of tricky, right? Because of like what is, a good source to use and what isn't now. And so there's a lot of back and forth. And, writers like Keith and Ryan will pull from all sorts of sources. We kind of have to work with LFL to see, what information does and doesn't work. So there's often a lot of back and forth, on my end, especially once the material gets to me, where we're kind of working with them to see, what information we want to include or not.
And Keith, you said that you created Ord Gimel?
Yeah. I mean, Andy had some input, too. Andy came to me and said he wanted to do an Ord planet. So right away I had that to work with. And I think he also told me that he wanted there to be some sort of royal family involved. So the Ord planets, like through my research, they were tied to like the Pious Day Crusades from the Essential Atlas. So that started informing like the basis of what that planet's history might have been. And it built out from there. And as for like doing the other planets, I think the trick with incorporating stuff from an old RPG book, especially like something done by WotC or West End Games, is like I don't want to feel like I'm rewriting like a reprint of the same old material and just updating it. I want it to be something different, right? Or at least focus on different parts for that planet. I mean, a planet's a big place. You don't have to talk about the same city.
Well, okay, talking about Ord Gimel, we had and maybe you can focus on this, we had a similar question from Imperial Spy who wanted to know, what were the goals or conditions kind of guiding that creation of Ord Gimel? Aside from what, what you mentioned earlier that Andy was looking for in that world, I mean, what were your design goals and what did you want to go for as you were crafting it?
So I think it was like, a lot of those old classic movies and stuff, or books, like The Three Musketeers, a lot of that, like, French Revolution kind of stuff was probably what inspired it the most, where you have, like, this question about who's the rightful heir to a throne and all these different factions sort of using it as a proxy war, like capitalist and communism did in this throughout the Cold War. We had all these proxy wars in different far-flung places that represented a broader conflict when we weren't in open conflict. So I think it was a combination of like old adventure books and, the Cold War from the after World War II, and make it Star Wars.
Awesome inspiration. Very awesome.
Now that goes off with the dealing with creating something whole out of, something new out of cloth. What about something as delicate as DAC itself? Sprague gave us a neat question. DAC is an important system even in canon. Were there any guidelines or prescriptions from Disney and Lucasfilm? Good book, by the way. Now, Fish, we know that you can't comment on any Disney Lucasfilm restrictions or guidelines or anything like that. So let's ask this in a different way. What goals did you have for the design of DAC?
Well, you know, as always, our goals are to, like, best represent the location as, you know, LFL, as the license holders see it, right? And to get our users the most accurate portrayal of this place. But beyond that, you know, we could obviously go on for many more pages than we did on Mon Cala and what is on the planet. So beyond that, our goals are to highlight aspects of the setting that will make for entertaining roleplay. You know, it's not our goal to, you know, go on about intricate histories and stuff. Well, we do that to a certain extent to kind of set up stories for you and stuff. One of our primary goal is to give the GM inspiration and tools to create really fun, entertaining stuff for their players in the moment. So we try to find aspects of the setting like that and highlight those.
Nice. Yeah, I had to write that planet, and it was the biggest headache of the whole assignment by far.
I can imagine.
There was just so much to go through, and I think I saved that one for the end on top of it, because I think with the other ones, I'm pretty sure I did, because with the other ones, it's like, oh man, I need to really investigate this and find a way to make a very quiet political sort of agri world interesting is like a theme park for Age of Rebellion players. And like, there was a lot more creative effort there with Mon Cala. I knew that like, oh, there's tons of stuff I could do. And, it's really exciting because they're like openly declared in support of the rebellion. So I was like, that one will come together easy, but there was so much canon to sift through. I was banging my head on the desk at the 11th hour writing Mon Cala, as I remember.
And there was still, there was still a good bit of conflicting canon in there, too, and that was something that he and I talked about at length. I think it was in a previous book, I believe it was Fly Casual, where I got the chance to kind of make this comment. Where I did the Quarren, and I kind of made this reconciliation between two legends canon, saying that, like, Coral Depth City from the old Zahn novels was the capital of Mon Cala. And then in the Clone Wars series cartoon, they said Mon Cala City is the capital. We just said, well, they're the same city. And then, you know, working with Keith, he takes it even further and comes up with an even better explanation as to why there's two different names for the same place.
And wasn't it like in the cartoon, the whole city's underwater exclusively, but in the books, it always had like a mostly surface component to it.
That's right.
Yeah, it was just like, how do we... Yeah, that was tough, because I think, like, the EU has used Mon Calamari like crazy, and it's been so defined, it's been in, like, every RPG line at length, and, like, to find a way to make things work together, or at least know what to ignore, because those history sections are small, right? And you want to have some sort of, like, sensical narrative in there that people can read and, like, feel like they have a grip on what the deal is with that planet. But right. It was a real tricky nightmare of a balancing act. But I think for all the planets, like, the goal is to like build a theme park for that either speaks specifically to one career or that kind of can speak to multiple careers, like find little hooks for all the different careers, and just make it an interesting place that's somehow the stakes there are vital to the rebellion. Like, there's something going on there that the rebels need to have. And if the players go there and screw something up, there might be repercussions. If they go there and do something good, the GM has a sense of how that might help, whether it's a reward, a duty reward, or, just something else, a story-based reward. You try to build that in, I think, to the write-ups.
For me, DAC was the most inspiring planetary ride I've been here. Fish, I kind of feel the same way you do about DAC. it just, and we kind of alluded to it earlier. For me, it was just reading that, and because it is such a canon heavy world, and there's so much of the Legends material that was focused on it, it kind of smacks you upside the head as a GM. It's like, God, it's very, very, it's not rare. It's rare that I'll read something in these books and I'll be like, why the hell am I not running something there? You know what I mean? It's like, why am I not doing that? What's wrong with you? And you know, you smack yourself around for that a bit, and that happened here. And so it was very, very inspiring to read that section. So, and
it was one of my favorites too, till I had to frickin' write it. Now I'm kind of traumatized by it. I'm not gonna lie.
Post-traumatic stress from writing.
A little bit.
So
the good thing about Dak. The good thing about Dak is there's a lot of background on it. The bad thing about Dak is that there's a lot of background on it.
Yeah. Okay, so Ryan, remind us again, which planets did you work on in this chapter?
I did the Roche asteroid field, Thyfira, Yavin 4. Keith and I kind of shared the Independence, although he did most of the work on it, really. And I did all of the bonus worlds.
Baby planets,
yeah,
all the baby planets. Okay, so
to
my
be fair, like I worked on an aircraft carrier, I wasn't gonna not stick my nose in the Independence, right?
Yeah,
now.
Yeah.
Now, okay, my second favorite locale, because I'm a Verpine fanatic, was the Roche asteroid field. Now I didn't smack myself around with it because I am running. I've used that setting a lot already in my games. But talk to me about that, guys. I mean, you know, for a lot of fans of this book, I mean, the things that people were chomping at the bit about and have gotten the most play and love online and the forums and everything else have been Dak and the Verpine, you know, home system. So talk to me about that, and kind of there's obviously some strong Legends EU material around that as well.
Yeah, Ryan wrote it, so.
Yeah, the Verpines are definitely one of my favorite species, and I really wanted to bring out the things that, I mean, to me, makes them interesting. And there's really only a handful of species like them in the EU, but I really wanted them to, like, to shine a light on why they're galactically renowned for their technical prowess. You have engineers and mega corporations come from all over the galaxy to consult with these guys because they have a knack for taking oddball problems and coming up with really unconventional solutions. They also take like existing technology and kind of turn it on its head and find brand new uses for them. So I really wanted to demonstrate those characteristics in where they came from in their day-to-day lives. And like, say, for instance, there was one thing that I did that was called the Beltway. And I thought, you know, how do these guys get around their system when it's a dense asteroid field and things like, you know, mass shadows prevent hyperdrive use so they can't get from one place to another. And standard sublight drives just aren't fast enough. And then I thought, like, well, you know, Verpine shatter guns were already a thing. So they're like essentially rail guns. So I thought, you know, hey, let's just up the scale on that and turn it into a mode of transportation. And then I remembered the pilot proving grounds from the old X-Wing and TIE Fighter video games.
Yeah.
And it all just sort of clicked. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's something that I definitely want to do.
Oh dude. I love now. Okay. Incorporating Project Shantipole. Made me giddy. But you know, that's a pretty rich piece of EU. It actually got referenced kind of recently in Star Wars Rebels, in the B-Wing episode.
Yeah, that was actually reconciled, I believe, Andy, helped with that. Because we tried to reconcile it as best we could without actually seeing that beforehand.
Yeah, Ryan, we were like on the edge of our seat when that episode was about to come on. Because I think the book was coming out like the same week, right?
Yeah,
Like when it finally came out and it's like, oh man, I hope it doesn't screw anything up, because we didn't know what happened in the episode at all.
Yeah,
especially around Rebels, there's a lot of tricky stuff, because you know it's coming out, and because of the time period it takes place in, I think they want to reference a lot of things, but they kind of have to pull it forward in time a bit. You've seen Rebels kind of pull forward things that happened later in old EU material, now happened sooner in Rebels. And so, you know, they're constantly, and like our books take a long time to print. So, you know, there are just things that are, there are things happening in Rebels that like just didn't exist when we were working on the book. So it's always tricky to kind of work between those two things.
I am thrilled that we also find the stats in Creatures and Challenges for this section for an Exogorth. That we actually have that now, and I have to comment. I'm not sure if it was you responsible for it, Ryan, or someone else, but the concept of having it be a creature but being treated as a starship is pretty pretty smart.
That was kind of how I pitched it, and I didn't know how it would fly, and obviously they liked it. So yeah, I was pretty pleased with how it came out.
Well, it makes sense. And Silhouette 7, is there anything that's been produced in the books to date that has a silhouette of 7?
Ship or creature?
Well, this is technically treated as a ship, so it's
oh, Star Destroyers are bigger.
What's the, I thought Star Destroyer silhouette was like 6.
No, Star Destroyers are like 8. There's even a couple Star Destroyers that are 9.
Okay, then I'm misremembering that. Okay.
Interdictor Cruisers are 7.
Okay. Okay.
That's still a really big worm.
That's a big worm, man.
Yeah, that is an absolutely huge worm.
Yeah, those are
worm.
those are the old adult worms, right? So.
Right.
Yeah.
Dude, that's enormous space slug.
That's fantastic. Absolutely fantastic. Okay, well, I want to press forward, guys. Be a bit respectful of your time. So, kind of moving on into rebel bases, you know, that we talk about in here in some of these sections, and also I really kind of want to touch on the base creation rules. I mean, obviously the AOR diplomat book and the Edge of the Empire colonist books and the Age of Rebellion GM kit establish rules for rebel bases. And Keith, I know you wrote those for the colonist book.
I don't think they were in the GM kit though.
Then were they not? Am I misremembering?
I mean, I wrote that. Yeah, that was the squad and squadron rules.
That's what I'm thinking of then. Okay, yes. But they were. It was in the Diplomat book in AOR, and then originally you wrote them in the Edge of the Empire colonist book.
Far Horizons, yeah. I think that's where the idea first.
Okay. And we dug heavily back in episode 60, All Your Base in Your Face, into Rebel bases. And we, you know, with that established base creation and advancement rules already in play, did that make it easier or harder to craft Rebel bases for, you know, info for this book?
Well, stepping back a second, I do want to say it's really interesting because I believe, Keith, you actually pitched putting Rebel base rules in the GM kit, but we never actually did it.
I totally did, but no, I think...
That's why it was throwing me off.
I don't think there was room, that's all.
Yeah, no, I think that was the case. We wanted to give it more coverage in a full book.
Funny.
But yeah, that was weird.
That's kind of creepy,
well,
okay.
Because I think the GM kit was like my third job after Colonists was my second or something like that. So I was like, I just did the Homestead rules and Sam seemed to like them, so I'll just do the same thing.
And yeah.
Probably written itself really quickly, but you... such is life. This is what happens.
Mm-hmm. But no, we took them into account, but the thing we wanted to do, and, you know, obviously this was, I believe, Sterling's section, all these bases. But one of the things we wanted to do is make sure these bases feel unique, right? And so we want to give them coverage that's accurate to the theme, but also, like, we don't want to just hand you stuff you could have created anyway. So because of that, you know, Sterling had free reign to create whatever he felt was appropriate thematically for the base so that it felt unique and different to GMs who pick up this book.
Okay. Because I mean, some of these bases were ridiculously creative, in terms of their design and creation, and that kind of plays into it. We had a few individual questions from some listeners about the bases presented. The first came from Eback the Cat, who's actually in chat right now, and he wanted to know specifically about Echo Base. it's such an iconic base. Was there concern at all about putting Echo Base into the book? And you know, I mean, you know, did you worry about getting it right?
Oh, Echo Base had a similar problem to the one we were discussing with Mon Cala earlier, where there's just, because it's so iconic, it's been covered everywhere, and there's so much information on this base. So one task Sterling had was really like chipping it down to what we feel is the core of the base and what we want to give people. Things like the cross-section books and stuff helped a lot with that. Because, you know, they also have the problem of, like, having to distill these locations down to, like, a spread or whatever. So I know he had a challenge with that, but that's kind of our goal, is to take all that information and kind of whittle it down to what we feel is the most important and the most, as I said earlier, the most important for creating good role-playing experiences.
Well, okay, go ahead. Wait, Phil, go ahead.
I love the fact that the Echo Base section has an entire, almost a full page sidebar on running the Empire Strikes Back battle and how you can involve the PCs in that. I think that's that was a really nice mechanism to play, because arguably the Age of Rebellion time frame is before Empire Strikes Back. You guys are playing after Yavin, before Empire Strikes Back. If you're playing what's considered to be the main timeline, the Battle of Hoth hasn't happened yet. I like the fact that you guys have presented us with a way to, or just presented GMs the way to run that battle and involve the PCs, and you've also kind of catered to GMs who might not want to tread into canon and have that effect, and folks who can just like say, screw it, if you guys want to intercept Darth Vader or you want to intercept Han Solo or whatnot, go for it.
Yeah, we often kind of delve further from our timeline just because we know, you know, like a lot of campaigns, you know, while they may start in our timeline, progress. And I mean, the invasion of Hoth is probably the most noteworthy thing that base did as far as like your average, you know, like Star Wars fan is concerned, right?
Right.
So that's the iconic thing about that base, is that invasion. So it's definitely something people are going to want to, when they pick up this book, they're going to want to do.
I like it.
As far as those four, you know, rebel base options, those hidden base options that are presented here, talking about, you know, Echo Base, Paulus Massa, Tirfan, and of course the Defiant Core. Do you have a favorite?
Oh, my favorite is probably Paulus Massa. I think it has the biggest potential for me for like RPG shenanigans. Just from like being on this asteroid, being like in space, you know, depressurization and all sorts of stuff. My players never managed to be in a single location long before it's halfway destroyed. So.
Oh wow. And 10 points for using the word shenanigans. That's very, very nice. Very nice. Keith, Ryan, did you guys have a favorite of the bases?
It was partial to the Defiant Core base, really. I really like just kind of the whole theme of the Rebel Alliance, you know, having to reuse things that they've found in order to, you know, continue the fight. So, I like that quite a bit.
For me, it was just cool to see Tirfan Outpost. I want to say that was part of the pitch when I talked about doing base rules in the GM kit, but I've always liked it. It screams like role-playing game headquarters kind of place for your party.
Yeah.
Yep.
And there's some cool iconic characters that come from there that were Tirfan Yellow Aces. So, it was cool to see that again. It's also cool that piece of art where you're looking up at the starfighters zipping out of the mouth of the hangar bay. Pretty awesome.
Through the waterfall,
And I think Sterling actually wrote the original Tirfan base back in, was it?
For West End Games?
For West End, I believe it originally showed up, yeah.
He might have.
Wouldn't surprise me.
And it comes full circle. that's phenomenal. Before this book was released and we had episode 60 talking about bases, we had a base build off where it was me, Dave, and Phil, and we built our different bases and homesteads and businesses, and we competed them against each other. And Phil, you made a rebel base.
Takeover Station.
Takeover Station, where it was the an abandoned Trade Federation command ship called the Hostile Takeover.
Yep.
In
orbit around a planet, it was like 2/3 of the thing was intact. One whole half of that arm was on the left. Arm was just snapped. Oh, excuse me. The port arm was snapped off, and systems were stored. Base were brought up, and it's now a hidden rebel base. And yeah, Chris, you can probably guess what my favorite location is in this book. There's actually another reason why I'm all over the Defiant Corps, and that's because I got this book, and I'm like, okay, who at FFG grabbed my notes for my another long shot campaign? Because my PCs in the past year found the crashed remains of the former Republic Star Destroyer that was renamed the Longshot, and they have been converting it into a base. And that's the mechanism about the Defiant Corps base that I absolutely love and will find to be the most handy for using in my another Longshot campaign going forward, is the fact that you have these stages of, okay, we have this cavern, we have this crashed ship. Stage one, here's what we need to bring back online. Once that's all done, we move on to stage two and restore these systems, and then stage three and restore these systems. And it's, I find that to be the most handy thing as far as my PCs trying to work with their Rebel Alliance, basically, to restore the ship, because the ship is never going to fly again. It's never going to fly again, but it's a great base of operations. And what of this crashed ship, this almost perfect, waiting to be exploited resource, can we restore and use as a base? Mm. And that's the most handy thing that I've seen in this book. And considering what else is in this book, that's saying a lot.
Very cool.
So thank you, whoever came up with Defiant Corps base.
Well, I think you can thank Sterling.
We worked together, but...
And Sterling actually did Hideouts and Strongholds for West End Games. I know that for sure. Mm-hmm. It's like one of his babies. So like building rebel bases is just kind of his thing.
Well, he's pretty darn good at it.
Dude is an architect, right?
He is.
Oh yeah, the one of the bases in the core book, the one he made up for it, is in this old casino, I think. When we were doing the map for it, he was like, all right, so I have some sketches. I'll send you guys over for art reference. I'll send these sketches.
Oh,
and we got, like, architect-level, like, specific sketches of this building.
Oh, you know, it's just something I threw together in CAD one night.
God. Yeah, for me, it would be like, you know, a crappy iPhone pic of a napkin, you know? Yeah.
So, Andy, you mean they look just like my maps that I send you?
Oh, yeah. Just like yours, yeah.
Looks like I did it with a crayon, yeah.
What is that, a potato next to a frisbee with some dots? Yeah, what is that?
I love it. Okay, well, let's move on. Past Rebel bases, we get really into the player options, okay? And we kind of start with new species as kind of one of the big things. You know, I guess as players especially, we pick up these supplement books, and one of the first things people dig to immediately because it informs their character choices is the new species. And you know, it's rather hard, I think, in a book like this to spend, you know, scores of pages discussing rebellion systems and history without giving the players the chance to really play some of these iconic creatures from these systems. Now, to that end, we do have three new species detailed in the book. The aforementioned Paulus Mossen, Quarren, and Verpine. So let's talk about them, because we have some questions around these species. And I think they're very interesting choices with some very interesting writing done around them. And first of all, Andy, I don't know if you'll be able to know off the top of your head, but do you know who's responsible for the species write-ups?
Marker, right?
I believe Marker wrote that chapter.
Okay. Okay. Well, we can pass it to him.
No, he did the modular encounters.
Oh.
Who wrote that chapter?
Gary Asselford then? I think he's the only other guy in the book.
I believe it was Gary, yeah.
Because it wasn't me or Ryan, for sure, and I doubt it was Sterling.
Man, we've got to get Gary on the show. I've been trying to get him on for a while.
Yeah, it was definitely Gary.
We haven't had Gary on since our Saga Edition days, man, and he's a good friend. Mm.
He's good people. Me and him hung out at Star Wars Celebration for a bit.
Yeah, he's great. He's great people. Good dad. And he, dude, okay.
So he does the Girl Scouts thing, right?
Dude, yeah. So he's a huge Girl Scout leader. He had sanctioned and is now a thing for Girl Scouts of America. They have a role-playing badge.
Nice. Pretty awesome.
That's amazing.
And like his entire Girl Scout troop, like he runs it and they do all, yeah, I'm like, you are a pimp, man. It's my dude's my hero. And plus my little girl just became a Daisy. So that's really,
something to look forward to. If she doesn't get that badge,
one badge wrong. You could help her with off the bat.
One, there is one. Let's talk about these species. Phil, man, do you want to dig us into the Polis Mossen?
Sure. The silent little telepathic anime characters of Star Wars universe.
They look like something from a Miyazaki film.
They do. They do. The creepy. Oh God! What the hell was that one? The one with the girl who rode the wolf.
From Mononoke. Yeah,
Mononoke.
Thank you, Princess Mononoke. Yeah, those creepy guys, the bouncy heads. All right, let's just ask the question: why the Polis Mossens? They have a fun little niche in the Star Wars universe, to be sure. But was there something specific you were looking for them to fill as far as the book design goes? Is it because you wanted to use the Polis Mossen asteroid field?
We used the asteroid field, so they were kind of on our list of one species that felt appropriate to this book. They also add some nice variety from our other options. They also, they may not be at any most people's like first pick. They do actually show up quite a bit in material. You know, the Polis Mossen base shows up like in the movies, which is pretty core.
It does.
They also show up quite a few times in Clone Wars, if not incidentally, a couple different times. So because of that. They kind of trickle to the top of the list.
Just sort of generally, is that generally something that you keep in mind when you start looking for races to put in books? What races have been on camera, be it they movie or TV?
Oh, absolutely. We definitely kind of look at how core they've been to Star Wars as a whole, right? You know, we want to get the most recognizable species into players' hands. Things, you know, and not necessarily like, you know, we have all sorts of different fans of the role-playing game. We have the, like, hardcore fan who's, you know, knows the EU very well. We have the fan who's, you know, just watched the movies. We have the fan who, you know, has seen the Clone Wars. And so, like, we have to consider all these different sources for, you know, what our players are going to want.
Now that makes sense. That answers to a large degree, I think, Sprague's question.
Yeah. Specifically, his question was, what was the process behind the species selection? Why three and not four, like in Lords of Nalhutta? As an example, Thyfera features as an important stronghold, but the Vratix were not chosen. Instead, Polis Mossens, which are numerically much less important. But no, you pretty much answered the question right there. The fact that the Thyferans and the Vratix were mentioned in a couple Stackpole books and throughout, you know, in passing in several of the other novels and legends, but the Polis Mossens were on camera.
Yeah, the Vratix also had the unfortunate they look
identical to the Verpine, right?
Yeah, exactly. We didn't want it to become like the bug species book, right?
The Great Book of Pests. Yeah, I did see that because there is one in the Thyferan section. You've got that picture of the giant Bacta tanks, and you can see two Vratix in the picture at least. And you're like, yeah, they're kind of like slightly bulkier Verpine. So
it is like praying mantis people, really.
Yeah. They're also very, very kind of niche. They're mostly focused on either producing Bacta or being terrorists on Thyfera.
Yeah. Well, and they're incredibly insular, too. So
yeah.
It'd be a lot more difficult to explain why a playable character would be of Radix out in the galaxy.
Not impossible, just unlikely.
Correct.
Moving on to the next of the species from the book.
Real quick, though, can I just say one thing?
You can.
So the
but just wait. Just one thing, Keaton. No.
It's just one, I swear. But Andy, the no vocal cords ability for the Polis Massens. I love these abilities on these species where it's like, here's a downside, but you could spend XP to get rid of it. I don't know if you did that first. I think I did that with the Dracellians and like some sort of primitive ability that I gave to them. But I'm pretty sure I stole that from something else earlier.
Well, our very first use of that downside that could be bought away, I believe, was the Gand in the original Edge of the Empire core book. So that was actually we had the downside just straight up on the Gand, and then during playtesting, you know, it came up that that's not the only way the Gand can be. And so we added in the option to buy it out because, you know, it was mainly a conceit created due to conflicting canon, but Gand can, you know, some breathe ammonia, some don't need to. And so we were like, well, we need to mechanically represent it. So it seemed like a simple way of doing it.
Just what a cool way to leverage the character creation system to do stuff like that. I love it. Just wanted to say that.
No, that's a really good point. Yeah. I think they were... Well, I think they're well designed. I'm just gonna say that. And I, with an intellect and willpower like they have, I want to make a Polis Massen artisan. I just want to pull out Force and Destiny and make an artisan.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Love it. Okay, the Quarren.
Quarren.
Cousins to the Mon Calamari. They've yet to be properly represented in the game line through now. But considering their historically belligerent nature and pseudo-xenophobia, what role do you see the Quarren playing in a rebellion party, especially since Mon Cals are the more visible part of the rebellion?
Well, I think a player that has a reason to be lightly antagonistic towards other players can lead to some funny role-playing, as long as your players can handle it. So I think, like, kind of introducing some inter-party bickering can be kind of fun, and they can play that role. They can also highlight, if you do have both a Mon Cal and a Quarren in a group, the dynamics of that civil war that went on for a very long time can kind of come through and make for some interesting storytelling.
If there's anyone out there who has a rebellion game going and they've got a Mon Cal and a Quarren in the same party, they need to do what they can to go out and find Stackpole's Rogue Squadron comics.
Ibitsum
and Nirin. Nirin is... Because up until then, the Mon... The Quarren were just... You know, they were the villainous species, sort of. They were just these angry, uptight squid people who were only a part of the scum and villainy of the galaxy. And I just love the dynamic that Ibsum and Nirin had, and, you know, a female Mon Cal and a male Quarren who were butting heads, and Ibsum had eternal patience and Nirin had just eternal pessimism, and just watching their relationship evolve over the course of the comic series was just it was some brilliant Stackpole writing. And of course the Rogue Squadron Rogue Squadron comics were just the penultimate rebellion group anyway, just good fun, good time. So, but specifically for a rebellion Quarren, that's perfect.
Ryan, you did the stats for these back in Fly Casual too, right?
I did. Yeah.
Yep.
There they are.
Yeah. That's
was the other book they were in. I knew they were out before, but I couldn't remember which book they were in.
I love the ink spray.
Yeah,
no, it was actually kind of challenging to write them in a different light, even back with in Fly Casual, instead of making them this like chronically antagonistic species, trying to make them something that the players could relate to. And that's kind of the route that I went, is that then, like, they actually, you know, they actually have a fair argument to be upset at the Mon Cala. It was an interesting way to play it.
Well, what was intriguing to me is this is obviously the first time we've seen Quarren in this particular line represented. Obviously, we saw them in Fly Casual, but Quarren to me, it really, really fit on that Edge of the Empire mentality, right? And it was heartening to see them here in the Rebellion line. But then again, when you're doing a write up on Dak, it's kind of hard to leave them out. And considering that Mon Cal are in the core book, you know what I mean, for this line? Yeah.
Got to do the other sentient species.
You got to do the other sentient. Yeah. It makes sense.
But no Wailadon stats, Andy. What's up with that?
There's Wailadon stats in here.
Womp womp.
There is Wailadon. Am I remembering correctly?
Did I do stats for those? I don't think I got away with
no,
that.
No, I don't think we put Wailadon stats.
Page
in this book.
34. Wailadon.
I mean, they're
arrival.
Mentioned. I made sure they got mentioned.
And no, there's a stat block, page
really?
34.
Oh, yeah, look at that. Enormous cetacean based marine mammals that live within Cala's seas.
All right, never mind. Yeah, they're in there.
And I wrote it and I completely forgot. My bad.
It's been a while. Fair point.
It happens.
It's there. Okay. Verpine. The fan favorite Verpine, the one species no one seems to argue should or should not have been in this book, because everyone loves them. They're so unusual. I'm personally just a huge fan of the way that the write up for this talks about the Verpine system. And you mentioned this earlier, Ryan. You know, with detailing out the Roshe asteroid field and weaving their species capabilities and their stats into their system in terms of their level of cultural or technological advancement in history. What was the thought process as went into the Verpine, you know, beyond what we've initially talked about?
Well, I mean, I can't speak much to it. That was a lot of Gary's creation. For my role, you know, we just kind of take what was created and then, like, make sure that everything feels right and balanced. If the writer ends up turning in something that's not thematically appropriate, we'll work with them on that. But in this case, everything came in great. So,
yeah, it's awesome. And again, Ryan, going back to the Roche system and talking about working in how the system is, and okay, well, you have this strange features. It's like, this isn't a system that I love the unanswered questions you guys hint at. Like, this isn't a system that can obviously develop sentient life. Yet it's the home system to the Verpine. So what happened? You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. There's a bunch of things from the Legends canon where they kind of, you know, theorize that Verpines might not even be from this galaxy. While I didn't want to, like, shine a light on that specifically, there definitely stuff like that's mentioned.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. So,
I want to try jamming their ability to hear or speak with a radio, with a comlink. I should be able to jam a Verpine.
Well, you can do it. This is the yes and system, Keith. You can,
I know. I'm just saying that's. I want to do it now.
So we're going to be broadcasting the Leak Spin song, like, on a loop, and it'll turn the entire Roche asteroid field completely insane.
I can dig that, because they can't really turn it off. It just kind of goes.
Oh, I love it. Okay, flipping the page from the Verpine, we get into equipment here, really getting into those new player options for equipment and gear. Now, along with the other player options presented, there was a lot of new equipment and gear introduced, like you do. Some of it really flavorful, and in some cases quite powerful. And we had one big listener question about this. From a design standpoint, Austin Catan was curious about the Verpine shatter weapons, which are understandably detailed here. And he said, what I wanted to know was the design reasoning behind the Verpine shatter weapons being as powerful as they are compared to other ranged weapons. I mean, historically speaking, Andy, I mean, they are quite powerful in Legends material, but I mean, how does rarity and cost balance them out? And I mean, are there any tips and advice you can give GMs for players wanting to make use of them?
Well, yeah. So we wanted them to stand out and feel special. But you compare them to some other material and other supplements, and they're not like extraordinarily powerful by any means, actually, statistically. And that's very much balanced out. You'll notice they have a very high cost for weapon and a very high rarity.
Yeah.
And that high cost is only compounded by the fact that they have a special rule on them in their write-up that you can find where they break down as you use them. So unless you're keeping up on maintenance, these guns are going to very quickly break down on you in high-stress combat. And so that only multiplies the expense of the gun. And as you're constantly fixing it or, you know, breaking it. So that kind of balances out its higher power, right? And the fact that, like, you know, if it does break, where are you going to find a replacement, right? Like, these things are exceptionally rare. So
everyone forgets to read the write-ups.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, look at that comment. You know, if a shattered gun is dropped or jarred, it will cease to function until repaired. That means that if your lowly stormtrooper group rolls 3 advantage but doesn't use any successes and disarms the shatter gun from the PC's hand, that gun is inoperable until repaired.
Yeah.
Yeah, that statement's basically free reign for the GM to do what they want with the weapon, right?
Oh, you rolled 2 threat, so you turned sharply and you stumbled and you whack the gun on the corner of a wall, knocking it out of alignment. You now have to fix it to use it again.
Yeah.
You now have
no longer in mint condition.
Yeah, you now have a 30,000 credit paperweight.
Dude. there's a lot of gear in here. I want to ask you two really quickly. I mean, there's some stuff I love the gear. The Bola carbine. Okay, I absolutely love the Bola carbine.
You would.
I would. It's so me. The Renegade heavy blaster pistol. The Soro sub or Renegade. Of course, all the unique and special Mon Cal weapons that are out there. The spore grenade. there's a lot of really interesting stuff. Do you guys have any favorites in our gear section? Stuff you would be excited to see on the table in use, or things that you saw in playtesting that were like being used?
I just like the modularity of the Mon Cal torpedo launcher. Just anything which fairly mechanically elegantly can swap out different ammo into the same gun. I always enjoy.
Yeah, that is interesting. We don't see that very often. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. That's good. Ryan, Keith?
It's actually a tough one. I'm kind of partial to the Verpine comlink again, with the Verpine, just because, just like what we were talking about before, I mean, they communicate via radio waves. So, you know, another species being able to tap in on that, being able to like extend communication, it's a pretty nifty idea. I like it. I like it.
Dude, false voice transmitter. Love it. Well, absolutely.
For me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the Soro Sub G2 repair droid, that's one of the droids from the Star Tours ride, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah,
it
that's is. Just, I can't
that,
believe
that. That is correct.
I can't believe that's in the book, and I love that it's there.
Looks like Johnny Five with legs.
A little bit.
With duck feet. His
parts are shown.
And the Verpine headband was also an interesting inclusion because it sort of harkens back to like the old KOTOR games where there was always like some weird headband that your person wore for whatever reason. It was like an equipable thing.
Oh yeah.
Like they needed a head slot item.
Right. And they made them headbands for all the Jedi, which was strange, but that's what they did.
That's right.
So it kind of like reminded me of that a little bit, but it keeps you awake horribly, but it keeps you awake.
Yeah, that was really interesting.
I also like that you got the Verpine Fiber Ultra Mesh armor in there too. That's also from the KOTOR games.
That was a nice mod. What's cool about this chapter in general is that, like, if you have a character from like one of the three species in here, there's like so much species specific gear just for you.
Mm. Mm.
The Verpine headband, there's some characters that I run that could, if they get hold of this, could make some really broken stuff with it. Because I've got characters with, you know, strain thresholds of 8 and wound thresholds of 27. that could, you know, yeah, really make use of that. Just saying. The one ultimate call out for me here, though, now that I'm going through and looking at it again, one of the first characters in Star Wars role playing I ever created in my life, I must have been about maybe 12 or 13 in WEG. I was going through the books and I saw this really cool drawing of a Mon Calamari organic gill.
Sure.
And when I was getting all my character stuff together and all the guys were like, "Yeah, man, you need to make sure you have a breath mask because you don't know." And I was like, "I'm not going to buy a breath mask. I'm going to buy this organic gill." And I was so proud of it. And we had to feed it, keep it alive, you know. Anyway, I was tickled to see that. So, very, very nice.
Duggan pointed out a neat piece of gear from the chat in Echo Base. The jump boots.
Jump boots. Yeah, jump boots. Yeah, since jetpacks have not been reprinted in AOR or Force and Destiny, jump boots is interesting. Very interesting.
It's cute. We like it.
We like it.
Speed 2 speed skating.
Kind of moving towards the end of the book, we've got another final listener question from regarding starships and vehicles. Obviously, Rebel Fleets, Starfighter Aces, they're just a very iconic part of not only Star Wars, but the Rebellion as well. And I don't think you could make this book without delving into a bunch of new starships. So our question is, initially, at this point, so many ships have been published across the three lines. Strongholds doesn't republish any existing ships, so was it difficult to decide on the right Rebellion ships to include? And before you answer that, on a related note, Rogue Corona was curious, why weren't any of the non-Mon Calamari Rebel ships mentioned in the book given stat blocks?
Well, we actually... With the ships, especially, it's kind of a mix of planning and giving the writers free rein. So we'll usually plan out a lot of the iconic ships and where we want to cover them, so that we make sure that we're kind of saving some cool content for different places, right? And so we wanted to cover, you know, obviously some of the MC ships here because of Mon Cala. And so we'll save some stuff and kind of plan out where we're going to distribute it across the lines. And then past that, we usually kind of pass it off to the writers and say, you know, dig into existing material, come up with some ships you want to cover from that. And then, like, where there are gaps, we can create new ships, you know, where, like, if we want some ships from a given planet that don't have anything made yet, you know, maybe we need a ship or two from there, and then we can create new material there. So it's this kind of combination where we reserve some content, and then beyond that, just kind of pass it off to the writers to do the research and dig up some good examples.
So what Andy's saying, I think, is part of the problem is that those three paragraphs in the Celestite write-up where I mentioned, like, 9 different Celestian starships, I probably should have sent that to Gary in an email early on. I think that's what he's saying.
Yeah, cross-communication definitely factors into it, yeah, because, you know, a writer in one chapter might want to reference some stuff, whereas a writer in the other is actually handling the profiles. So sometimes, you know, we can not cross the wires as much as we'd like to.
Plus, I have to figure that you guys are saving some nice ships for the Commander book that's coming out soon.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there's a short list at the end of the Solace chapter now.
Just a short list.
Short list.
Just a short list. Very, very nice. And do you guys have any favorite ships in the book?
I like the MC 30C. I don't actually think there's art of it, but I really like the design of it, and I've been having a lot of fun using them in Armada, so I'm partial to them.
That's true. Anyone looking for a picture of it can go look at the model for Armada.
That's true. That's very true. That's not. It's not a bad cap ship, man.
No, it's not.
It's really not great handling for a cap ship.
Good shields, good hull.
Good shields, good hull. Yeah, that's a good cap ship right there. It's a very good cap ship. I don't know. Ryan? Keith?
Not really, although I was kind of impressed that a Nen Carvan ship or airspeeder got included in there. I thought that was pretty cool.
The hang glider from Wedge, right?
Right.
Yeah, the sky swooper.
I love it. And there's freaking submarines in this book, guys.
Yes, there are.
Yeah. All right, Navy man. Yes.
I'm just saying you could endlessly reskin those. They at least give you like a starting point.
Absolutely.
For any sort of submarine type ship on other aquatic planets or whatever. I think it's important that they're included.
I couldn't agree more. And considering that as we talk about, DAC is one of those locales that is going to inspire so many GMs, you have to include aquatic craft. You can't get away.
But even if your party needs to infiltrate the cloning tubes of Kamino, they can use submarine. Like, there's all sorts of water planets, either on film or through the EU or expanded canon, whatever we want to call it now.
Yep. And, of course, the book ends with modular encounters, which we know and love. And, you know, we talked about and presented as an idea, you know, long before FFG started publishing them on this show. I'm just saying. I'm not blaming. I'm just saying. but we absolutely love them. No real big questions here. There were some beautiful modular encounters. My personal favorite is Claustrophobia. But, again, it's a chance to play with that awesome character that with the art that I love so much, and go to Sullust, which is such an underused location in my experience. Do you guys have any thoughts on modular encounters or any favorites that you really liked?
I really would like to play out Phantoms in the Dark with the right GM. I think it could be really atmospheric, the kind of like, hiding ships hiding in this asteroid field, you know, these stealth ships kind of zipping around and you trying to hunt them down kind of has this like tense feel to it. Kind of reminds me, there's like an episode of BSG kind of like that. I think that would be a really fun one to run. I haven't actually gotten a chance to, but
yeah, you'd need the right GM, man, but it could be epic. A beautiful art too. Page 123. Great art.
It's my favorite, too. Before me and Ryan were writing for FFG, we were doing the fandom comics stuff. And one of the first comics we did was Kraken's Crew, which dealt with, like, it was like, you know, a fan comic story about cloaking devices and where they were coming from. And it was going to get into all that sort of stuff. So to see all that here is just kind of neat to see them talking about Stygium cloaking devices and stuff.
Yeah, it's great stuff. Great stuff. Excellent. Well, gentlemen, this is the book, and I'm staring at it now, and I'm looking at all, 150 roughly pages, 140 pages, of everything that's in it, and I feel it's a solid edition. Very interesting to get your thoughts on it. Before we go, and I really want to thank each of you for taking the time to come on and talk with us for now, for Pete's sake, an hour and 40 minutes at this point, about this book. Any final thoughts on the title and any other advice you can give to GMs that are thinking about picking this up, and any other points regarding work on it?
I think we've covered it pretty well from my end. I will say to GMs to remember too that, you know, obviously this book covers, you know, your most iconic places from the Rebellion in the setting, but the Rebellion's happening everywhere. And, you know, our other game lines like Edge of the Empire also have some great setting source books that you can use for all sorts of ideas for your campaign.
Very nice. Very nice. Good. That's absolutely correct. It's one of those things, despite the way it's structured, I mean, again, it's three lines, but all one giant game. So the hard work done on write-ups elsewhere is there. So,
and there are enough little nods in here to the other two lines that anyone who's running any type of game can utilize these locations, these bases, the gear, obviously, but even the modular encounters. I could totally see an Edge of the Empire crew needing to deal with something if they do like a supply run, not even related to the Rebel Alliance, to the Polis Massa base, and they could get dragged into to the problems with Phantoms in the Dark.
Yeah. Yeah. Keith, Ryan, any final thoughts?
Go buy it.
It'll look pretty on your shelf.
Yeah, I just think if you're running an AOR game or any game in the line, you have to go places. These are cool places to go, so you should go there.
Dude, Geiger Streak is in chat saying, being a Navy man myself, it was very realistic.
So, oh, he's talking about the
reduced crew.
The reduced crew rules from the Independence page. There's a little sidebar.
Yeah. And it was little stuff like that, guys. I thought it was a very good effort. So, yes, go out and go buy it. And, gentlemen, thank you all for taking the time to come on and talk to us. We really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, and thank you guys for having us. It's always fun.
Thank you. Big thanks also to the listeners who sent in questions for the book and are, of course, watching live in chat as we broadcast live. We want you to become a member of the Gamer Nation. We want you to get to d20radio.com, click on the forums button, register, and post your mind. You can also leave us a liner and tell us why you never listen to the Order 66 podcast. You can email those to us, gmchris@d20radio.com, gmphil, or gmdave@d20radio.com, or call us at the D20 Radio hotline, 262-D20-RADIO. That's 262-320-7234. And Phil, we've got a pretty hefty show planned for 2 weeks' time, yeah?
Yes, we do. January 17th, we're going to be doing an episode tentatively lined up as the State of the Galaxy, trying to run games in the Force Awakens era.
Dude.
We're going to be joined by longtime D20 Radio alum Christopher West, and maybe another guest if we can line him up.
Dude, yeah, I'm super excited about that episode. Already working on the notes for it, and it's going to be good. But that promises to be another spoilerific episode, really kind of following up our talk last episode for episode 67. So grateful for that. But until then, Gamer Nation, thank you all for listening, and we will be back in 2 weeks' time. Once again, big thanks to Andrew Fisher, Ryan Brooks, Keith Kappel. You guys are awesome. And Gamer Nation, big thanks to you. This is GM Chris wishing you peace, love, and good gaming.
And this is GM Phil. May the dice be with you.
This podcast and related websites are not endorsed by Lucasfilm Limited, the Walt Disney Corporation, 20th Century Fox, or Fantasy Flight Games. It is intended for educational and informational purposes only. Star Wars, the Star Wars logo, all names, pictures, or references to any Star Wars vehicles, characters, or other Star Wars related items are registered trademarks of Lucasfilm Limited, Fantasy Flight Games, or their respective trademark or copyright holders. All original content of this podcast, including any audio, visual, or textual information, is the intellectual property of the Order 66 Podcast and the Gamer Nation LLC.